Hey everybody, welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. Back again with the full group. I got Matt Kachansky, retired OIG senior leader, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now a member of our advised SIU management team. Jason, who is Matt's counterpart, retired senior executive from the OIG, the Western UPIC director, and now a member of our management team here. And Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge of the LA field office for the OIG and a member of our SIU team as well. So we want to get right into it. We've got a little bit of an offshoot conversation, but something I think that we will tie back to SIUs and investigations and all of that. And it has to do with HIPAA. So first, I will provide a very large disclaimer. It's as if we're doing a PowerPoint presentation, and we are not lawyers. We're not here to have a discussion about HIPAA protections per se. We're not here to have a discussion about the regulations regarding HIPAA and if there are violations of HIPAA. There are people that do that, that are experts in that. We want to have just a little bit more of a generalized conversation about just some of the wacky things that kind of go on and some of the nuances that are out there and things that SIU management leadership can consider in formulating their policies and see kind of where that goes. So, Matt, I want to start with you on this. What brought this to light was we were having a conversation, and what we learned in one of our conversations was that professional sports teams generally, and we'll talk about the NFL in particular, they actually have some clauses in their contracts in which when you become a professional athlete, you waive all rights to, or most rights under HIPAA, to have your health information kept private. And that I thought was kind of interesting, right? So let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I did a little bit of research on this, being a fantasy football owner and waiting, with bated breath for the 11:30 a.m. release of the active list and who's injured and all that. But when HIPAA was passed, this is anecdotal in my memory, there was a time when the NFL would not disclose the injury to a player, whether it was during the game or during the week. They wouldn't do it because they weren't sure as to how they applied in the HIPAA law, whether the HIPAA law applied to the NFL. Well, then I was doing some research and it finally came that the NFL is not considered a covered entity, even though they provide medical care, they've got trainers, they've got medical staff, they give medical treatments to players. They're not considered a covered entity, so they are not covered by HIPAA. So right. The NFL can release this information. And going beyond that, under their collective bargaining agreement and with their relationship with the league, policies with the league, they are obligated to release the injury information about their players in advance of the games, seemingly for transparency, but I'm sure casinos and fantasy football influence has a lot to do with that. And there's been instances when, I think you're showing it right now,
right,
the teams have been fined for not doing that or for being less than truthful in their assessment of their players.
That's a great example. The NFL doled out a $20,000 fine to the legacy Redskins, which are now the Commanders, for RG3, right? For him, a $20,000 fine for not disclosing a concussion, right? That's just one example of those instances where you essentially sign away a whole bunch of privacy protections that are in place because of, being a professional athlete.
Yeah, and there was some examples of players going into the hospital after an injury, and then the press pressuring the hospital to release the information. In some instances, they did that, violating HIPAA, but I think it was taken to court by the individual player, and they didn't get anything because had it been the league, they could have released it, so there was no materiality to the claim.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's almost like a third party liability that doesn't exist, right? So the hospital releases that information, and the question then becomes, was it the hospital's right to release that information? And some of those crazy legal nuances that are out there, but it does spark like a whole bunch of conversation about you know, under what circumstances can information be released and not released? And I think what kind of got this going was I was on a phone call with a law firm a few weeks ago where, you know, part of the discussion had to do with an SIU that went to do an on-site at a hospital. And one of the lawyers who was not a healthcare lawyer was a business lawyer, but was part of this call, said, well, is that a HIPAA violation for a plan to go in and ask for those records? And it's, well, you know, it's a little bit like when you're talking in the Medicare space about, you know, the inspection authority and things of that sort. And we'll get to that in a second. But Wade, I want to go to you because from twofold, right, when a provider becomes a participating provider in a plan, they essentially, you know, are saying I'm agreeing to open up the books and records, which include that. But there are still some carve outs to those kinds of things. So, you know, one of the big things at the OIG was we had the ability to serve a variety of subpoenas, and subpoenas, there's a law enforcement carve out for HIPAA, right? Law enforcement has the ability to subpoena records. There's a whole bunch of those. We actually do a training module on the differences of the subpoenas that are out there. We talk about CIDs, we talk about OIG subpoenas, grand jury subpoenas, HIPAA subpoenas, and the like. But one thing that the general public, I think, is not fully conversant in is the fact that the OIG has, under statutory authority, this ability to inspect records. And we would use what was commonly known as our internal form is the OI-2, which is the request for information. And that is often used in lieu of a subpoena, right? So talk a little bit about when, you know, particularly in your time when you're in management about, you know, instances where an OI-2 would be used. What is the OI-2? What does it allow us to do? And what does it allow us not to do?
Well, I think an easy way to look at the OI-2 is it's almost like a hyperlink to like the statutes and the regulations that give us the authority to look at records. So it's really nothing more than a piece of paper that says, based on this statute, this regulation, you must let these agents review, photocopy, whatever, these records immediately, not like, well, you can come back in 30 days. No, it's they can look at them right now. But so there's no real magic to the form other than it's saying, based on this authority, these agents have the right to look at these records now. And as you pointed out, it's a little bit different from different types of subpoenas, but it's still, in order to like issue an OI-2 or have the agents act on an OI-2, it's still the requirements to, we can't just look for records willy-nilly. It has to be part of an investigation. So there has to be some, not really backstopping, but there has to be a reason for the request for the records, and that's based on a certain allegation that the OIG is looking into. And it's, again, it's separate from a grand jury subpoena and an IG subpoena, but the IG subpoena and the OI-2 are kind of an in-house where, as management at the local field office, they the SAC, for example, can sign an OIG subpoena or an OI-2 and say these records are required as part of this ongoing investigation.
Right. So let's talk about, Matt, did you have something you wanted to add on
that? I was just say, and in each of those forms, if I remember right, there is some HIPAA language in there stating what these records were for and how they were going to be used and that they'd be in compliance with HIPAA. And the other is that both the subpoena and the OI-2 are based on our regulatory authority. And so there has to be a regulatory, at least the possibility of a regulatory resolution to the matter for us to have access to those records. So it could be an exclusion, CMPL or whatever, had to be possible for us to be able to use those.
Exactly, right. It's not just willy-nilly, right? There's actual language in there. But so kind of the offshoot of that, Wade, is that there are certain carve-outs in which, even though you may be able to get some records, there may be some limits. And the biggest area is in mental health and substance abuse, right? So talk a little bit about that and sort of, because you're doing some of those, you're doing some of that work now on our SIU team and some of the nuances of those records.
Yeah, I kind of look at the records related to substance abuse and mental health as almost like a HIPAA 2.0, where there's additional regulations and things that have to be followed. I believe, I don't think in the OIG days, I don't think you could access those records, certainly not with an OI2, or I think even an IG subpoena. I believe it had to be through a court order. If it had certain ramifications of being from a mental health facility or a substance abuse facility, we couldn't use our typical IG subpoena or an OI2. I'm pretty sure it was either, I believe it had to be a court order to get it. I could be wrong on that, but I know it was more stringent regulations, and it was definitely different if it was something that didn't involve substance abuse or mental health.
Right. So a little bit of this is, generally speaking, under Title V of the United States Code, that's actually the code that establishes the Inspector General Act. And so are a lot of the authorities that OIGs have falls under where Title V is, and the OI2 references Title V. But, you know, this kind of gets to kind of that piece, Jason, where I want to bring you in, which is, it's understanding what those policies are, understanding that regulatory landscape, because from a managerial perspective, and you're doing right now, you're very entrenched in a process improvement project with one of our SIU clients. But even through, you know, being at HHS-OIG and over at the UPIC, is, you know, that fine line between what you should be able to get, what you can get, and then how you go and you use that information. And, you know, obviously, if you use Wade's example of, you know, what if you got mental health or substance abuse records that were provided by a provider in good faith, but were really going to be outside of what you should have been able to get, right? So from a management perspective, understanding those policies. So this is kind of a more broader conversation than just HIPAA, but if we're focusing on things like HIPAA, it's understanding that landscape from a policy perspective. And as a manager, I have to think that when your agents or your investigators are making requests for records, that there has to be a pumping of the brakes to be able to understand, what are you asking for? What's the context of what you're asking for? And how does that fit into either the contractual or regulatory framework?
Well, I think operations and procedures are certainly more my bailiwick than fantasy teams, since there aren't too many fantasy teams for curling or artistic swimming. But in all seriousness, the universe of where a medical record might go and how it might be used is enormous. And I think that the Office of Inspector General has, you know, really good guardrails in place to protect the information and to address those issues. I would just suggest that the private enterprises like SIUs and such probably should be looking at their policies and procedures to see that that's addressed. I mean, right down to the rules of comportment. So when an investigator is speaking to a provider and there's some sort of verbal discussion, what, you know, providers sometimes blur things out when they're, you know, speaking, like what is the documentation of that information when it has PHI or PII in it, for that matter. So all those implications have to be considered as part of one's policies and procedures.
Right. And, you know, while we're sitting here, I just brought up Title V of the federal code, which establishes the, you know, it's essentially the IG Act, as it's generally noted. And Section 404 specifically, you know, is the area where it's, you know, it's the duty and responsibility of each inspector general to provide policy direction for and to conduct and coordinate audits and investigations relating to the program. So a lot of the statutory authority that OIGs and HHS specifically relies on is that Title V. But, you know, getting back to your point, Jay, is that you've got to have a good policy in place, which requires coordination, right? We talk a lot about that. So if you're in an SIU and you're looking to request records on an FWA case, should you be coordinating with your in-house counsel to be ensured that the request that you're making is within the confines of your contractual relationship? But also, if you're working on an FWA case in which you're using the F word, right, fraud, and there's the potential of a referral going out to law enforcement, does that then require that second level of coordination internally, but then also empowering that law enforcement liaison who maybe has that extra level of scrutiny to say, hold on, pump the brakes, right? So from a policy perspective, I think, you know, if you're running an SIU or you're a team leader in SIU, that coordination becomes even more important because it's not just the requesting of the records, it's what follows once you've gotten those records. And particularly if those records reflect some malfeasance, are you in a position now where those records are absolutely unusable?
And just one more thing to your point, which is that documentation is essential. So it's one thing to have a good policy in place about the handling of the records internally, but I would be treating that information as evidence, if you will, that there should be a chain of custody situation. So as it moves around, and presumably it's moving around in a way that is consistent with the law, then there's also documentation of that. So then down the line, the organization can protect itself from accusation of not handling PHI properly.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Jason, because it's really about, it's really not just documenting the file to put a piece of paper to the file. It's that, you know, if you're going to request records and it's for something that may be nuanced, maybe you do want to write something to the file to say on such and such a date you had a conversation with so-and-so, you explained the facts of the case, they authorized the, you know, the letter or what have you. It really would be no different than, you know, any other thing that you would be documenting, because at the end of the day, right, that's kind of the piece of the puzzle. Wait, I want to go back to you because, you know, that becomes a salient piece, particularly when you're looking at getting records that might have certain carve-outs like substance abuse, mental health, behavioral health. It's being able to pull those policies, those regulations, and then in turn, having the conversations with the people who are ultimately going to bless that request, right? So, you know, from an investigator's perspective, but also from a managerial perspective, it's proper case documentation is going to get you where you need to go so that you can, it's almost like, you know, justifying your actions, right? So when you're sitting there and you're doing your cases now, and even when you were the line ASAC where you're reviewing these, right, it's proper documentation. It's not just putting a piece of paper to the file to say, hey, I have a piece of paper in the file.
Yeah, I think just like the note sections in the various, you know, case management systems, they all have an an area where you can put free form notes, and it's just you don't want to get too you know, too busy with it, so it's confusing. But to just put, like you said, a note to the file explaining the situation, maybe a reference to a statute or regulation, just so, you know, down the line somebody can go back and kind of almost follow your train of thought. And it's also important, especially I would say more so in the SIU, where I think people don't stay in the SIU for, you know, decades or a career like they tend to do in the government. So if somebody leaves and someone else has to pick up that case where it was left off, having those detailed notes that are sometimes just more of a documentation of the investigator's, you know, thought process, but having those in the case file will help the new investigator get up to speed on where they are in the case.
Yeah, I mean, not to be macabre, but if tomorrow, you know, an investigator got hit by a bus, someone needs to be able to pick up on that case and kind of understand. And there's a ramp up time, obviously, right? But someone needs to be able to pick up and look at that, you know, to kind of see. So, Matt, I want to go to you for the kind of the final thoughts on this, because it was a little surprising to see that this is the case in the professional sports realm. And I think we've tried hard in this podcast to kind of bring how that all factors back into SIUs and what have you. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, professional athletes are paid based upon their health status, right? I mean, look at Let's take Aaron Rodgers, right? Everybody's talking about Aaron Rodgers coming to the Jets. He was going to be the great hope for the potential of them getting into the playoffs or the Super Bowl. And fourth play of the first game, tears his Achilles and he's out. So as a fantasy football guy, if you've got Aaron Rodgers, you're a very unhappy fella. So in the general sense, like taking that out of the mix, is it a good policy? Like, I know, you know, we're just kind of spitballing, but is making professional athletes' health status a good idea?
No, I mean, I think it should be limited, similar to access to psychiatric records and substance abuse records. It needs to be limited. You know, is the player going to play or not? End of story. Not he's got a high ankle sprain involving the, you know, whatever ligaments, da 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 da. Who needs to know that? Nobody. They need to know whether the person's going to be playing or not, or how long they're going to be out. And for a fan's perspective, that's all they need. You know, and if there's some examples of, I remember a quarterback in the NFL who was having some behavioral health issues, and they were advertising them on national television.
Right.
Yeah, it's just horrible.
And that was actually going to be my follow-up question to you is, right, so people's health status isn't always about whether or not they've got a torn Achilles, right? You've got professional athletes, just like anybody else, that are suffering mental health issues, the pressures of being able to stay in the game and have a career, CTE issues, right? There was a lot about the guy from the Patriots, right? Aaron Rodriguez, I think, was the guy.
Hernandez,
right? CTE. I mean, granted, he committed some really heinous acts, but, you know, at the end of the day, was CTE a part of that? Was not a part of it? And I'm not trying to make this like a discussion in that sense, but at some point, like, is there a line to be drawn? You know, a professional athlete who gets embroiled in substance abuse, for example, because, hey, I've got to stay healthy and play this game, so I am now hooked on OxyContin because I need to be healthy. Like, the collateral effects of all this, it's an interesting conversation that kind of becomes more of a social conversation, right? Other than really HIPAA. But, you know, certainly there's a lot of these nuances that are out there. It was amazing to me. Obviously we see this in the news that athletes get injured, they have a torn Achilles, they're out. But the fact that like the NFL fines the team for not disclosing it and, you know, what are those, you know, what are the nuances of it are just fascinating to me.
Yeah, the on the opposite side of the spectrum is the National Hockey League. When one of their players gets hurt, you never hear anything other than it was an upper body injury or lower body injury. They never get into the specifics of it. And no one's injured. No one's, you know, at a disadvantage because of that.
Right. Well, I'm assuming that there isn't a very large fantasy hockey league.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, as our
that's
resident
the Wisconsin sports, guy.
As our resident sports guys, you could tell us about that. But look, this was an interesting topic. I think that, you know, what we really tried to do in this week's podcast was to really make that connection on how this kind of stuff really does permeate into the investigative world, the SIU world, and all of that. I think it's, you know, it's going to be useful for us in a future podcast. I would like to spend some more time talking about subpoenas and the different types of subpoenas. We recently did a training course for a group where we talked about it, and people were really interested because people don't understand those nuances. And understanding, for example, in the subpoena or the OI2 world, understanding those nuances can actually help providers and law firms understand, are you a target subject or a witness of a case in some instances, right? We can have a lot more discussion on that. So always the time goes very quickly. It's good to see that the memo circulated to Jason and I on the collared shirts this week. We'll get this right at some point. I know we will. We're working right now just to get Jason out of the basement. That's number one. Get him out of the basement, get him into the conference room. I'm hoping
all those lockers behind him, they have PHI information all locked up.
That is true. Compliance in the telework. So Guys, it's always great having this time with you. I do enjoy it very much. I look forward every week to having these conversations. Again, to our audience, thanks again for participating by listening and joining in and sending us your comments, concerns, and questions. We love getting them. We try to provide feedback when we get them. If you're not getting our newsletter, you can get it. hello@advisehealth.com. You can get our newsletter. You can get our podcasts. You can get them on Spotify. You can get them on YouTube. We'll be doing our October LinkedIn Live. It's going to be with Julie Janeway. We'll be announcing the date for that. Julie is our in-house general counsel. A lot of things that we're going to be talking about in the regulatory space. She's not a criminal lawyer. She is a civil regulatory lawyer. We're going to spend some time talking about the regulatory and the general healthcare landscape involving things like the OIG's model compliance guidance, the importance of having that, creating some protections for yourself. We're putting that agenda together right now with Julie. It's going to be great. You'll see some information about that in the coming days for October's LinkedIn Live. So as always, thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.